KEXP thanks contributing donors and the Real Networks Foundation for supporting Mind Over Matters.
This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Wes Jackson, founder and president of the Land Institute. Wes is the author of several books, including New Roots for Agriculture and Becoming Native to This Place, and is widely recognized as a leader in the international movement for a more sustainable agriculture. He was a 1990 Pew Conservation Scholar, in 1992 became a MacArthur Fellow, and in 2000 received the Right Livelihood Award, called the Alternative Nobel Prize. Wes Jackson is here today to tell us about the 50-year Farm Bill and moving toward more sustainable agriculture. Welcome, Wes.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about the Land Institute?
Well, we've been in existence since 1976. We're a small outfit. We have a staff of about 30, 31, a few more than that in the summertime, like right now, with harvest being here. Mostly PhD-level scientists that are working at plant breeding, and also a soil ecologist, a plant pathologist. We're working to develop a perennial grain crops that would be grown in mixtures that would be something of a mimic of a never-plowed prairie. We're concerned about soil erosion, fossil fuel dependency for agriculture, chemical contamination of the countryside. We note that a prairie is a real economy. It features material recycling, runs on contemporary sunlight. So the prairie is sort of our model. A deciduous forest does the same, an alpine meadow. Essentially all of nature's ecosystems feature perennials in mixtures. And agriculture reversed that some 10,000 years ago when we began to feature annuals in monocultures. And with that came the idea that if we're to get food, nature has to be subdued or ignored. And so we're saying that the way nature's ecosystems work has a lot to tell us about how to have a sustainable food supply. But that requires some exercise of human cleverness, therefore the plant breeding work that is going on here, the genetics and plant breeding.
What is your evaluation of our current agricultural system in the U.S.?
Well, our current agricultural system is really a derivative of some 10,000 years of humans growing food. You know, this is like 5% of our total evolutionary history that we've been doing agriculture. So as I mentioned a moment ago, the idea that nature is to be subdued or ignored is a common theme in agriculture. But also, there's another jumping off point in the collective consciousness of those in interest in the science that gets applied to agriculture. And that goes back to around 1600 when the early architects of modern science, people like Francis Bacon, René Descartes, and others, plus the Royal Society, began to place priority on the parts of things over the whole. And then that moved along, and then starting about 250 years ago with the Industrial Revolution, we began to very slowly, bring fossil fuel into the possibility of agriculture, and that's around 1750. And then in Drake's oil well is in 1859. And even though we had had natural gas for a while, we started using it a lot for power right after that. So now natural gas figures in. So we now have an industrialized agriculture where natural gas serves as the feedstock to take atmospheric nitrogen and turn it into ammonia. And the consequence of that has been high nitrogen levels in water to the point that various towns and cities have had to put in very expensive equipment to get the nitrogen out of the waters. And then, of course, we have the dead zones that are now around the world. There are probably 1,000 of them. And so, in addition to that, we put chemicals out there that our tissues have no evolutionary experience with, the pesticides. So the chemicals on the landscape have been serious problems and in our waters. And then, of course, the fossil fuel dependency standing behind our food supply. But it comes from that long history. And then could just tell just a quick little story. I stood with a group of people on a lawn as we were getting ready to have dinner in the loft of a barn, and looked down on a field where there were terraces, and in that field, between the terraces and then in the flat part of the field, it had been burned down with an herbicide, and they would be planting either Roundup Ready corn or Roundup Ready soybeans. So we have the two-molecule approach now to stopping soil erosion. The molecule of the DNA that is the gene for resistance to Roundup, that herbicide, and then, of course, the herbicide itself. So this is moving from the ecosystem level downward to the molecular end. And so that is a derivative of this long history of an increasing placement of priority on the parts of things over the whole. And in that field, I still saw soil erosion. And in fact, the catchment pond at the bottom of that field was loaded with mud. So this is the best that industrial agriculture has to offer in what is called no-till farming or minimum-till farming. Well, it's because they're using annuals. And in monoculture, that we have this problem. So what we're arguing is that if we go up that hierarchy of structure, going upward, say, from atom to above molecule to cell to tissue to organ to organism and to the ecosystem itself, therein lies the future of an agriculture that is sustainable. But that requires the perennial and mixtures.
Would you say more about what led you to go to perennials as a solution to our agricultural crisis?
Well, with perennials, you have the roots there year-round. There are different root architectures if you have diversity. And with the annual, for instance, the wheat plant, we harvest our wheat here in June, and then we don't plant until September. So there is this three-month period. And then when the wheat plant is sprouting, the surface is still exposed, and even if it gets full canopy cover, you don't have much of a root system to hold the soil, and therefore the stuff of which we are made is headed down the rivers, down the hill, and eventually to the streams and the ocean.
Would you give some examples of annual crops?
Well, the number one crop of the planet in terms of calories is rice. And the number two crop is wheat. It's number one in acres. Rice is number two in acres, but in terms of calories. Number three is corn. Then number four is potato. Of course, we'd have to dig that up to get the tuber. Then after that comes grasses and legumes. Humans are primarily grass seed eaters. So I've just mentioned three grasses. And the grain crops are a combination of grasses, legumes like soybeans, and the oilseed crops like sunflowers. So that represents 70% of our acreage and about 70% of our calories. On a global basis, it's about 68%. In the U.S., it's about 75%. So we're primarily grass seed eaters and secondarily legume seed eaters. So the vegetables that are healthy and necessary for us, the fruits and the nuts, the vegetables are only like 3 or 4% of our acreage. So it's these vast fields of grains that provide the bread, the pasta, the pancakes, and so on, that are the calories that humanity mostly runs on.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Wes Jackson, founder and president of the Land Institute. Our topic is the 50-year Farm Bill and moving toward more sustainable agriculture. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Are there examples of perennial crops?
None of our high-yielding crops are perennials. We have two tree crops that make the top 20, number 19 and 20, banana and coconut. But no, that's the problem. There are no perennial grain crops.
If you look in nature, what is the ratio of annuals to perennials?
Oh, essentially all of nature's ecosystems feature perennials. I mean, there are some ecosystems that do feature annuals, but by and large, the planet is covered with perennial mixtures. And of course, that is the reason being that, well, let's think of it this way. Look at the periodic chart of the elements that we see in our chemistry classrooms. There are 114 or so. In the upper third of that chart are 20-some elements that go into life. It doesn't matter whether you're a redwood or a whale or a corn plant or a soybean plant or a bacterium or a Drosophila fly or a human or a mouse or an elephant. 20-some go into organisms, and from the upper third of that chart, there are only four of those elements that are in the atmospheric commons: carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. The other 20-some are in the soil. So it makes sense, then, that nature's ecosystems would have evolved to protect the ecological capital, to prevent deficit spending of those nutrients. But as I said earlier, agriculture reversed that and started featuring annuals in monocultures 10,000 years ago.
Would you elaborate on how annual and perennial crops or plants each affect the health of the soil?
Well, an annual plant is one usually with, first of all, roots that aren't there year-round. Some of them are longer than in others. And the problem with the annual is that you have to tear the ground up every year in order to plant the seed. Or if you use minimum till or no till, then you burn down with an herbicide and then plant your seed and then put in the herbicide-resistant seed. With the perennial, you have a very long root system that is there year-round. And during its growth, it will be slopping tissue that was then available for the bacteria, for the fungi, for the little invertebrates that are running around in the soil, various worms, and so on. So here you have, on the one hand, a diverse ecosystem that is devoted to the cycling of the materials and making, mineralizing some of the dead organisms that are underground and making those nutrients then available for crop growth. Annuals will do that too, but on a much more limited scale. And as I said, they're not there year-round. And so the forces of wind and rain take the soil seaward.
How far along are you at the Land Institute in developing perennial crops that can be used commercially by farmers?
Well, we're still quite a ways out. When I first published on this, writing in 1977, I said that this would take 50 to 100 years. And we will probably have one of our perennial grains, Kernza, a relative of wheat. We're eating flour from it now, but it won't be farmer ready to work with an agronomist for another 10 to 12 years. With sorghum, which is an extremely important crop in Africa, it'll be about the same time, maybe a little more. We're also working on wheat to make it a perennial, crossing a wild relative and bringing genes in from the wheat plant. supported by the overall architecture of the perennial relative, working on sunflowers, on relatives of sunflowers. Those are going to take longer. Corn, we reckon, will take 50 years. That's been the primary killer of our continent. And rice, we're supporting the upland perennial rice in China. And that program is moving along very well. Our guys go over there, a couple of them every year, and we've got important colleagues at work there. So there's no quick fix on this. This is more like the climate change. Well, we'll have something faster than we've solved the climate problem, and we'll also be there before the population problem has been solved, before we get that to zero and have to go negative. When we first started out, a lot of people were saying, well, that's going to take too long. Well, now we're sort of in the middle of having solutions.
Would you also say more about how you are integrating perennial plants into polycultures rather than monocultures and your experience with perennial grain mixtures?
Well, here's the thing. A legume is a plant that has a symbiotic relationship with a bacterium and will fix nitrogen. So we're assuming there's going to have to be a legume in the mix and one that we hope will produce grain. To that end, we're working with Illinois bundle flower. So we have, in fact, just to deal with the question of how you're going to plant and harvest perennial polycultures, several years ago now, we planted corn, sorghum, sunflowers, and soybeans together with an air drill. I think a little over 8 acres it was. And then just left it. We also planted them in monocultures. And then we, with the combine, opened up the concave on the combine, cut the air so it wouldn't blow the sunflower seeds out the back, and we harvested this instant granola. And then we separated the seeds with a seed cleaner using screens. We got pretty good separation. So we feel that, you know, those are mechanical engineering problems. The larger concerns are agronomic.
Would you now tell us about the 50-year farm bill you have proposed? What is the goal of this bill?
Well, currently the American agricultural landscape has 20% perennials, 80% annuals. And we want to reverse that over a period of 50 years and use the 5-year farm bills as mere mileposts toward that end. We're not going to stop anything all at once, but we're going to start a tendency. The 5-year farm bills address exports, commodities, subsidies, some soil conservation measures, and the food programs. But it's export policy that drives, well, it's turned our crops into commodities, and therefore we have the subsidies. This is to help offset the balance of payment deficit for the likes of foreign oil, as well as the gewgaws we get out of China. A 50-year farm bill would be a program using the 5-year farm bills as mileposts, as I mentioned, but it would be adding larger, more sustainable end goals to existing programs. For instance, it would be devoted to protecting the soil from erosion, cut fossil fuel dependence to zero, sequester carbon, reduce toxics in the soil and water, and manage the nitrogen more carefully. It would reduce the dead zones, cut the wasteful water use, and preserve or rebuild farm communities. So it's a difference between an extractive economy and a renewable economy. We want to draw down the capital stock. We want to stop the drawing down of the capital stock of the continent.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Wes Jackson, founder and president of the Land Institute. Our topic is the 50-year farm bill and moving toward more sustainable agriculture. What are some of the tools or mechanisms that you propose using to bring about these goals?
Well, I would like to see the U.S. government get interested in this. Our U.S. government tends to have very short time frames, except for something like a space program. We think this is the most important space program because planet Earth is in space and we've not yet learned to live here. But it's going to require constituency building to make it happen. And our best friends in the so-called sustainable ag movement, our best friends are those people, and many of them have been interested in everything from organic to local food, you know, community-supported agriculture, the slow food movement, and so on. So, unfortunately, they don't have any clout when we're dealing with the big commodities folk that are in the Midwest. Most of these sustainable ag places are up in the Northeast, the West Coast, down into California, Washington, Oregon, California. Those are hot spots. And then on the East Coast in New England, maybe down to Washington, D.C. And then in Chicago, there's some. But the great Midwest, which is where most of the calories are grown, that a lot of these, most of these sustainable ag people are eating, that's where the soils are eroding, the chemicals are contaminating the land and the water. So what we're hoping is that we could get something of a extension of the values of the sustainable ag folk to get some, you know, some public policy. As things stand, there's something like 16%, I think I read or heard, of the U.S. population that elects 50 of our senators. And so, therefore, the commodities people, agribusiness types, are the ones that have undue leverage on most of the agricultural landscape.
What kind of response are you getting to your ideas at this point?
Well, we took the farm bill to Washington, D.C., and gave it to the Deputy Secretary, Kathleen Merrigan, one of our spiritual allies, but we have heard very little since. So I think our country is so tied up with other problems, and we've got actually too much food in a way if we look at the obesity problem in America. So that's just off the table in a way. Now, there's a little bit of language that the Secretary's office, I think, must have sent to the White House for President Obama's. I'm just assuming that's where it went. But it did mention perennials, and it did mention the Land Institute. But the thing is, it was just such a piddling little bit of money. And we weren't asking for anything for ourselves. What we were asking for is 80 PhD-level scientists, 30 ecologists within the U.S. Department of Agriculture land grant system to go to work on this effort. And we looked in at about $50 million a year, which is peanuts in a sense. So it's just somehow not getting the kind of traction that we had hoped.
How do you plan to follow up?
Well, I don't know what else to do. I mean, we're busy here. I mean, right now our guys are, and a young crew, they're out there harvesting and they're weighing up seeds and, you know, taking data and so on. So our line of work has not really been much in the realm of policy. We have spent some time with policy. But it's partly a problem with humanity, I think. You know, our time frame is until the next election. Our time frame is until the next year. Our time frame is the here and now. We're not very hardwired for thinking long term. So our fear is that by the time we really have the crises, it'll be too late. So I don't know. I'd like some help from somebody telling us what we ought to do. All I know is that we're pretty maxed out. I mean, we're a small outfit with a rather small budget. We've got a nice research facility we're about to move into, and we're making good progress, but there needs to be more.
Would you say a few more words about how climate change would be affected if we go to perennial plants?
Well, there would be some sequestering of carbon in the soil, but it's not going to come close to offsetting the rate that we are burning coal, oil, natural gas. I do think that the perennial polycultures will be more resilient to a warmer planet. I mean, I know from back in the 1930s, for instance, here in the Dust Bowl region of the continent, University of Nebraska, a young master's student whose last name was Noll, N-O-L-L, did a study comparing a never-plowed prairie with an adjacent wheat field. happened to be the driest year on record, 1932 or 3, somewhere in there. And all the wheat plants died, but the prairie came back, suggesting to me that a hot, dry environment, that your perennial roots all the way maybe 10, 12 feet deep versus those that are, say, 18 inches deep, they're going to be more likely to survive drought. So I think we're looking at a more resilient agriculture with perennial grains.
If your 50-year farm bill is implemented and we go to more perennials, what will our agricultural landscape look like in the future?
Well, you can imagine who won't be interested in this. With perennials, of course, they just keep coming up every year, so the seed houses won't be interested. With seed species diversity, you have chemical diversity. So it takes a tremendous enzyme system on the part of an insect or a pathogen to give you the epidemic. So the pesticide people won't be interested. With fewer passes through the field, say harvest, and after some initial planting, you can see the farm machinery people won't have so much. And then what we're looking to is the possibility of some of the biomass providing biofuel for on-farm traction and tractors, combines, and so on. That means that the fossil fuel industry won't be interested. So we're talking about an agriculture in which the reward goes to the farmer and the landscape rather than the suppliers of inputs.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, they might write the Deputy Secretary of Agriculture and say, what's happened with the 50-year farm bill that Wendell Berry, Fred Kirschman, and Wes Jackson brought to Washington? And is there any chance, why should that not get attention, given that our agricultural landscape is being severely compromised by modern industrial methods? And we'd also like to see more people out on the land and the revitalization of small farms, rural communities, whatever. In other words, we would like to bring the culture back to agriculture.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Wes.
Well, thank you for hearing me out.
You have just been listening to Wes Jackson, founder and president of the Land Institute. For more information, check on the web at www.landinstitute.org. Again, that's landinstitute.org. This coming fall, Wes Jackson will give a talk at the University of Washington on November 30th. Again, November 30th at the University of Washington. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.